From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. We've all seen it. A parent keeps the motor running while waiting for the kids after school. A bus idles at the end of the line for 15 minutes before starting the route again. There's little doubt that all that idling wastes gas and releases tons of carbon dioxide into the air. And so dozens of cities, counties, and states have some sort of idle reduction law on the books. Salt Lake City is proposing its own version, but not everyone is on board. Do bans work? How would you enforce it? And would it kill businesses with drive-through service? Today on the program, pros and cons of mandating idle-free. Plus, funding troubles for the Parley's Trail Plan and the draw at Sugar House. We'll get an update. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Few argue with the facts that idling your car wastes gas and pollutes the air, but should it be against the law? Salt Lake City is considering an ordinance that would bar idling for more than 2 minutes in a car. And joining me now to talk about the proposal, Bianca Shreve is assistant to the chief of staff of Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. And Bianca Shreve joins me in studio. Bianca, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Also with us, Charisse Udell is founder and president of Utah Moms for Clean Air, and Charisse Udell is here as well. Thanks so much for being here.
Good morning.
Because of today's legislative interim session, Melva Sein, who is president of the Utah Restaurant Association, and Mont Evans, who represents the Utah Bankers Association, are tied up at the Capitol, but they say they'll be joining us by phone later in the program. If you would like to join us, you are welcome as well. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Later on in the program, a plea for funds for the draw in Sugar House. That's part of the Parley's Trail system. But first, idling in the city. Would an anti-idling mandate encourage you to turn the key? Again, 801-355-TALK is our number. Charisse Udell, I wanted to start with you. You've been instrumental in the Idle Free movement in Utah. Tell us about the Idle Free campaign. What got it started?
Well, as far as I remember, actually, Patty White, a teacher at Morningside Elementary, was the first, as far as I know, to initiate the Idle Free awareness campaign here in Utah. And she just did it with her sixth graders. And they came up with some Idle Free songs. They did some public education at their school, educating their parents and families. So it was very localized at Morningside Elementary. And then Utah Moms for Clean Air heard about what they were doing. We talked to them and some of their students. And then we decided, hey, let's just take this a little larger and expand it out to other schools, which we did, like at Emerson Elementary. They had a very successful Idle Free campaign, and it's just blossomed from there because, you know, Utah Moms started doing it. We started to get individual moms launching it at their own schools, and then from there, the mayor's office, Mayor Becker got involved, and Mayor Caroon got involved, and now you see those ubiquitous Idle Free stickers everywhere, and you see them on cars, you see them at the airport, you see them at some drive-thrus, and I think it's fabulous how this message has just spread.
What does the latest research on idling show? What I don't know if you can parse this out, but what portion of pollutants can be attributed to idling cars? Do you know?
I know that in Salt Lake Valley, you know, here along the Wasatch Front, 50 to 60% of our air pollution is attributed to vehicular emissions. I don't know exactly, maybe Bianca, you do, what percentage of that comes from idling cars versus driving cars. I actually don't know that breakdown. Do you?
Sure.
I'm not sure, but I would emphasize that idle-free policies and idle-free campaigns are aimed at improving the local effects of car emissions, which really impact our kids going to school, people who are near idling cars, employees at a drive-through restaurant, for instance. And so we're not quite sure what the cumulative effects of an idle-free policy would be, but there's no doubt that curbing our idling will really impact our local air quality for our kids and our residents.
Bianca, regulating idling cars in Salt Lake City is nothing new. Maybe give some context to this, starting back in 2007 with former Mayor Rocky Anderson.
Under Mayor Anderson, we started, the city implemented a 10-second idle-free policy for its city fleet. That was kind of the first step in towards idle-free policies in the city. And last year, at about this time, it was in September of 2010, during idle-free month, Mayor Becker sought public comment on a citywide idle-free ordinance that would apply to all residents. And we received public input for a six-week period. A lot of it was very, very positive, and the public really thought what we were trying to do was important. And that public process really guided a lot of really important changes to the ordinance that we felt really informed our decision that we ended up transmitting to the City Council in March. So the council will be likely considering it later this month or sometime in the next few weeks. So that's kind of the process and how we got here.
What are some of those changes that you kind of tweaked the ordinance?
We made an exception, a few important exemptions that really informed, that really ended up changing the final product. Idling for defrosting our windshields, that seemed like something that we thought was a really practical change. Exemptions for emergency vehicles and other auxiliary vehicles that need to idle for their own equipment purposes. We reduced the fine structure. The public generally felt that the fines were too steep in the draft proposal, and so we reduced those quite a bit too, because we felt that this was really aimed at educating rather than being heavy-handed. So that was a really important change as well.
We're talking about the idling ordinance, or the anti-idling ordinance, as some call it, that Salt Lake City Council is considering, and Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker is encouraging. With us in studio, Bianca Shreve, Assistant to the Chief of Staff of Mayor Becker. Also with us, Charisse Udell, Founder and President of Utah Moms for Clean Air. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. So, Bianca Shreve, you really see the public mandate as a natural progression, a next step in what Salt Lake City has been doing in terms of idling.
Yeah, I would say so, although I would emphasize that we are trying to be gentle in our approach. The first citation in this ordinance, should it pass, would be a warning. It would be largely complaint-based, so, you know, and our parking enforcement would generally be you know, carrying on their responsibilities and then letting the community know as they were seeing vehicles idling. So while we do think it's a really great policy, we also want to find the middle ground where there is education and using our employees to really interface with the public in an educational way by the citation, the first citation as a warning, and other efforts to educate.
Charisse Udell, you see this as a good first step in preventing people in lessening the pollutants that are in our air, especially here in the Salt Lake Valley. What is going on right now with air quality and pollution and some of the problems that your group sees?
Well, I will give you some statistics here just to put it into perspective, since you asked earlier. For example, in New York, which actually has passed an idle-free ordinance, and just to compare actually to New York, and their fine is actually up to $2,000 is what New York is charging for these violations.
How much is it?
Up to $2,000.
Wow.
So actually we're going very light here in Utah, and which shows the point that really this is a public education campaign, not to chastise people and to penalize them per se, but just educate them and get them on board. But idling for just 10 minutes per day, so I have some New York statistics because I did a lot of research in passing this this ordinance. Idling just 10 minutes per day for New Yorkers is 27 gallons of fuel a year. And in New York, that equals 28 million gallons of fuel a year. And in 10 years, that's 280 million gallons of fuel that's just wasted for idling. And another example is, and this would apply anywhere, but one car dropping off and picking up kids at school creates 3 pounds of pollution each month. That's for one car. So imagine a school with 1,000 cars coming. That's 3,000 pounds of pollution that's being released just on drop-off and pickup. And what's interesting about the way air pollution works is it often accumulates in zones. So, for example, around school zones and around freeway zones, you're going to get a much higher concentration of these dangerous byproducts of our of using cars and fossil fuels. So you're going to get more PM2.5. You're going to get more benzene, for example, that's known to cause cancer. It's directly linked to childhood leukemia. There's been a preliminary study that I think is very interesting and also very frightening that around school zones where there are pickup zones and drop-off zones for kids via car, that there are higher rates of breast cancer for the women living in that zone. And that's preliminary, but the researchers said they were shocked by actually the data that they had looked at, and they're going to continue to look at that. But so it extends just beyond the kids, but also for the neighborhood.
Hmm. Bianca Shreve, let's talk about the ordinance specifically. Would you be targeting the areas that are known to be concentrated with idling cars, like school zones, like drive-through restaurants? Or is it kind of just a general blanket enforcement?
It'll be a little of both, I think. I think that our parking enforcement will be doing their day-to-day business and probably run into people who we, you know, want to remind people that there's an ordinance in place. But we do want to go after the people who are egregious in their idling. So a lot of it will be complaint-based. So if there is a lot of idling in front of a hotel, maybe a large bus, or if there's a particular school that seems to have an issue, then we will, reach out to them and make sure they understand what we're trying to accomplish. So it's a little bit of both.
And how is idling even defined in the ordinance? What's the language? Because say I'm, you know, at Taco Bell and I'm waiting for my order to be ready, but I'm moving, I'm inching forward every couple of seconds. Is that idling?
Yeah, technically, no. If you're in movement in any way, you aren't idling. You are slowly making your way through a drive-through. Of course, the spirit of the ordinance is to change behavior and to encourage people to turn off their cars. So by definition, that would not be idling, but we hope that through this ordinance and through our education efforts that people waiting in a drive-thru for a coffee or, waiting for a sandwich can think about those things, even when they may not be in one place for longer than 2 minutes, that they think about it.
And can you enforce this anti-idling policy on private property, or does it have to be in the public space?
Yes, it can be on private property. Since the airshed is a public good, then we certainly do have the ability to do that.
Bianca Shreve is with us, Assistant to the Chief of Staff of Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Also, Charisse Udell, Founder and President of Utah Moms for Clean Air. We're talking about a proposed ordinance to ban idling in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. There is widespread support for a proposed ban on idling in Salt Lake City, but would a hefty fine encourage you to turn off your motor? And how would the law be enforced? You can join us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Joining us for the idling discussion, Bianca Shreve, Assistant to the Chief of Staff of Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Also with us, Charisse Udell, founder and president of Utah Moms for Clean Air. And joining us now on the line is Mont Evans, who represents the Utah Bankers Association. And Mont, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you very much. I apologize for misunderstanding the instructions. until this morning when I printed out your email, and so I apologize for not being there in person.
No problem. I understand that you're busy on the Hill. I understand that you testified recently at the Salt Lake City Council meeting about the ordinance that's being proposed by Mayor Ralph Becker. What are some of the concerns of your clients, Utah Bankers?
Now, I need to clarify, first of all, while I do work with the Bankers Association, the Restaurant Association, they both testified in the hearing. This morning, I'm not representing them directly, just my own personal views.
Okay.
I think the concern that needs to be expressed is just the process that has been followed, the opportunity to have a meaningful dialogue on this issue with the I understand that there's been an elongated process that has gone on in establishing this ordinance, and yet both from the testimony in the council hearing, both the Bankers Association and the Restaurant Association were left out of that discussion, even though they will be impacted by the ordinance. The Restaurant Association did express that they had heard of the ordinance some time ago, but had been told that they would be that drive-throughs would be excluded. And then, as it the ordinance was developed much later, without them being contacted, why they are being included. I think their number one concern is the process.
Okay. Bianca Shreve, people at the table, as you've been developing this ordinance, did you involve all parties, including the bankers?
When we were in the public comment period, we consulted with different groups, but we did also have the ordinance itself on Open City Hall and tried to be as public as possible with receiving input. So we did have it publicized for 6 weeks, and I'm unsure where the concept came from that we were exempting drive-thrus. We are troubled by idling and drive-thrus, and we do want to address that behavior there. As I told you, Jennifer, in the spirit of the ordinance, if cars are moving ahead 2 minutes, you know, every 10 seconds, maybe rolling a few inches, they're technically within the bounds of the ordinance. However, we still, by the spirit of the ordinance, we want to keep people turning their key and thinking about how their behavior can really make a big difference. And we're still open to having the Restaurant Association and the Banking Association at the table to be a partner and to work with us. I think wherever we land, we certainly will work with them to try and educate the public on participating, and we think that this is a good ordinance, and we don't expect it's going to impact businesses negatively. We really just want to get people to think about turning their key when they're waiting for a sandwich, or when they're waiting for a coffee, or when they're waiting to do their banking business. And we think that everyone can win. Stands to win by passing this ordinance.
So Mont, your objections to the process aside, what about the intent of the ordinance itself? What are the particular issues that you have with a ban of an anti-idling ban of 2 minutes within the city limits?
Now, I need to go back to that process issue because that's very, very important. And if you want to get everybody on board, if you want to get everybody participating fully and enthusiastically, why bring them into the table? I even wrote a letter to Mayor Becker and specifically requested that that he bring those representatives from those two groups together to talk about the ordinances and come up with ways so that it's not as obtrusive to businesses as it appears to be. I want to make that request again publicly on the air as the representative of the mayor's office, why don't you bring all parties to the table? Why don't you bring them in and see if there's a way that you can get them to agree?
Again,
I
just want to hear your specific objections to the ordinance. How do you think that it would be more beneficial for businesses? What kind of changes to the proposed ordinances would your groups suggest?
Well, again, my groups, most of all, want to be brought to the table, and they need to have the opportunity to express that. This is an ordinance that is on the very extreme. Most of the ordinances across the United States have a significantly longer idling time, and it allows a police power to come onto private property and ticket customers of a business.
Okay. Now, you have specific concerns with the time limit. A two-minute limit seems too restrictive, too short to allow businesses to get their business done. Bianca Shreve, how'd you arrive at the two-minute time?
We thought it was a good time simply because 2 minutes is a perfect length for our parking enforcement to notice a violation and to let people know if they have surpassed the two-minute limit. We proposed a two-minute limit also just to be, I think, aggressive on idling. And when we received public comment on the ordinance, it was actually surprising how many people commented to say that it was actually very generous. Most of the comments about the time limit itself were actually thinking it was too long, and so it was really a lot of the public comment that we received that we kept it at the 2 minutes. The nationwide standard is typically about 3 to 5.
Would the mayor's office be flexible on that to maybe go to 3, maybe go to 4 if the bankers and the restaurants are very concerned about that?
Well, the ordinance has been sent to the city council. I know in the work session last week that was something that they were talking about. And we still think it would be good if they land at 3 minutes or if they're at 2. The city council is deliberating that, and I'm sure they're open to receiving Mont and other folks' comment about the limit itself.
Charisse Udell, Utah Moms for Clean Air.
I would think personally that the banking and restaurant community would be delighted about this ordinance because their workers who are standing in those drive-through window service areas are breathing an incredible amount of toxic air pollution. And it's only going to be a matter of time before one of these employees has a deadly asthma attack or gets leukemia or some other disease that is actually linked to breathing polluted air, and there's probably going to be a lawsuit. So I would think that this would be protecting the business owners from the liability of actually a dangerous work situation. So I would think that they would be super excited that they don't have to enforce it on their customers and can just say, well, it's a city ordinance, and we'd appreciate it if you could follow that ordinance and protect our workers.
Mont Evans, your response?
Well, both the restaurants and the bankers are active community participants, and they will support whatever ordinance is passed by the governing body. In the many years of people participating in drive-thrus, I am unaware of any of those problems that were just referred to as occurring. But certainly restaurants and bankers are good corporate citizens of Salt Lake City, and they will support the decisions of the governing body of Salt Lake City. But going back to the two-minute limit, a comparison is that in our research, the research was conducted by one of those organizations, I think there was one other example around the United States where there was a two-minute limit put in. Every other ordinance that we saw was 5 minutes or longer. So in essence, what has been adopted here is the very extreme. But again, bankers and restaurants want to be partners with Salt Lake City in whatever they're doing. But on this issue, they have been excluded from the discussion. They were given initial, one of them was given an, information contrary to what was developed later on. And if we want to bring people together on issues in this country, you need to bring everybody at the table to allow them to participate. Those two groups specifically have been excluded. Since they found out about the ordinance, they have made attempts to have that discussion, and up to this point continue to be left out of the process.
Montavins, who is a former mayor of Riverton, also a lobbyist for the Utah Bankers Association as well as the Utah Restaurant Association, is with us. Also, Bianca Shreve, assistant to the chief of staff of Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker, and Charisse Udell, founder and president of Utah Moms for Clean Air. Mont, you expressed some concern about enforcement on private property. How would this differ from, you know, any police enforcement on any private property? How is it different in your mind?
Well, in my mind, the goal that was being sought by the mayor's office was to educate people on the issue. And so the mechanism that has been chosen to educate people is a police power to enforce a an ordinance through a drive-in window. Most people, when they drive, are doing business, are expecting a very that they're not going to be expecting a ticket for idling their engine. Again, I would encourage the mayor's office to bring those other groups to the table. And see if there are some suggestions to be incorporated to the law so that it's less obtrusive to customers who are trying to do commerce, participate in business in Salt Lake City.
So, Bianca Shreve, to Mont Evans' point that, you know, if you are patronizing a local business, you don't expect to get a ticket just for being in their parking space. If you are, you know, if you're robbing the 7-Eleven, you can expect some kind of a law enforcement reaction. But for the average customer to be criminalized this way, your thoughts?
Well, I would remind Mont and your listeners that the first citation is a warning, and no, I think it has to be pretty egregious for you to actually get cited under this ordinance. We think, while some folks think it might be over the top, I assure you that what we're trying to accomplish is a middle ground between the enforcement side and the education side. And what we're really trying to accomplish is, I think, to let people know or give people enough notice before they actually do get cited that it is a law. And accompanying this ordinance would be a 6-month grace period and an education period, which I do want to emphasize as well. And that would be an opportunity for our businesses, for our residents, for our community groups to get more educated, to let people know. We understand that not everyone's going to know the ordinance offhand, but through our education efforts, the citation is the first citation is a warning. We think that it has to get pretty extreme before someone actually would get cited, and they would have plenty of notice and education beforehand.
Charisse Udell, I want to turn to you, Charisse. State law already has banned if you leave a vehicle running while it's unattended and the keys are in the ignition, you're outside the law. As you mentioned, there's this extensive public relations campaign. You see the stickers on just about every other car. Why a mandate? Isn't the voluntary program working? Aren't we already cutting emissions? And why do you feel like the city needs to have an enforcement mechanism?
Well, I feel all the volunteers have already volunteered, and we now need to move beyond that population. So those that either don't know about the message that idling actually creates a lot of unnecessary pollution, that we need to move beyond that at this point. So, everyone I know that's aware of it is already doing it, so it's the next step. So it reminds me of the Don't Be a Litter Bug campaign back in the 70s. So I remember as a child, people would chuck their trash out of the car on the freeway, for example. And I remember seeing all these Don't Be a Litter Bug big billboards on the freeway, and that there were fines associated with littering. And in a way, idling pollution from your vehicle is like littering in a way. It's littering the air. And so we're kind of just extending that, aren't we, in some ways? The Don't Litter Bug campaign, it took time to educate people, but over time the social norm changed. And now you don't want to be caught throwing trash out of your car. It's sort of a social embarrassment. And I would love to see idling to be a social embarrassment, that if you're the, one car in the parking lot idling, that people are going to kind of give you the hairy eyeball, and you're going to be embarrassed and want to turn off your car. And how those parallel each other is that, throwing car trash or trash out your car window and idling are both externalities. They're called negative externalities because the person doing it is, quote unquote, benefiting from the act. But then there's everyone else who's not benefiting from the act because, you have to see all the trash along the freeway, which is an eyesore, not to mention that it can cause accidents. And just like idling creates unhealthy situations around that vehicle for children and for the elderly and actually just for the general population as a whole. So in a way, you don't have a right to do something that is going to harm innocent bystanders. And idling fits that exactly because there's 30 times more pollution created by an idling car than a car that's actually moving.
Monta Evans, I'd like to get your thoughts on this because I've seen signs starting to crop up at local restaurants saying, please do not idle your car for longer than is necessary on our establishment grounds. Can you talk about the mandate idea and why the state should or should not set a standard legally?
Again, lots of ways to do this, and I just noticed what has occurred on this radio program today is that several times brought up to the representative from the mayor's office the idea of bringing all parties to the table and come up with the most effective law that you can. Seeking the middle ground means that you bring all people to the table. Seeking the middle ground means that you don't go to the very extreme of all the ordinances in the United States on this issue. And again, would publicly ask the representative of the mayor's office to bring bring those groups to the table that have been excluded and allow them to participate and come up with ways that accomplish the things that the mayor's office is attempting to do to educate people on the issue. And some of the restaurant associations very proactively started to pass out signs to their restaurants so that they can start the process. They are good corporate citizens of the community. They want to do business in Salt Lake City. Bring them to the table. Ask that directly to the representative of the mayor's office. Bring them to the table.
I understand that the mayor has already submitted the ordinance to the city council. City Council Chair Jill Love said last week that this will be considered on October 25th. So I don't know if that time for negotiation has passed, but are you approaching Salt Lake City Council members with your point of view at this point?
Well, certainly have, but again, would like to have the bully pulpit of the mayor's office in support of negotiating a solution to this that brings all people to the table. You see that in this country from the top to the bottom, where people are excluded from the process, one group gets in power and enacts ordinances without taking into consideration the other point of view. It'd be nice to be able to have that dialogue, and again, specifically request the representative of the mayor's office bring everybody together. That is a function of the mayor. Let's see if we can come up with an ordinance that's workable for everybody.
Bianca Shreve?
I would say that in this situation, we simply, you know, can't make everybody happy, I would say. I mean, I think we're trying to address a behavior that really affects the health of our citizens. And if voluntary measures worked successfully, then we wouldn't be in a position where we'd have to put an ordinance into place. So I would challenge that those volunteer opt-in campaigns have only gotten us so far, as Charisse mentioned. And I would say that if idling was a concern for our business community, then I think complying with the ordinance shouldn't be an issue.
Charisse Udell.
Well, I want to say, Mott, that Utah Moms for Clean Air was not specifically invited to participate in the process, but we heard about it. It was important to us, and we showed up, and we've been participating for the last few months with numerous comments, and we showed up at the hearing, made comments. And actually at that hearing, there were representatives from your community, from the banking industry and the restaurant industry, so they were heard. And I know that the vote was actually postponed so that they could acknowledge the concerns of that industry. And so you were always welcome, just as Utah Moms for Clean Air was always welcome. So if you didn't show up earlier in the process, I think you need to take responsibility for that and stop blaming the mayor's office. From what I understand from Mayor Becker, when I've spoken with him, he wanted as much input from as many groups as possible, but he can't force you to show up if you don't show up.
We are going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Charisse Udell, founder and president of Utah Moms for Clean Air. Charisse, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Bianca Shreve, assistant to the chief of staff of Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Thanks to you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And Mont Evans joining us by phone, a lobbyist for the Utah Bankers Association as well as the Utah Restaurant Association. Mont, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Again, Salt Lake City Council is planning to consider this ordinance on idling October 25th. That's next Tuesday. You can find out more information on our website, kcpw.org. Up next, the draw at Sugar House hits a snag. We'll get the details on that. But first, a quick break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The draw at Sugar House is not only envisioned as a tunnel connecting Sugar House Park and the Sugar House Business District, it's also intended to be a showpiece, an impressive public art display, or as one planner put it, the jewel of the Parley's Trail. But that artistic vision is now in jeopardy, and joining us to tell the details is Juan Arceloretta. He's chair of the Parley's Rails, Trails, and Tunnels Coalition, known as PRAT. And Juan joins me in studio. Juan, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
If you've got questions or comments about the Parley's Trail or the Sugar House draw, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Juan, before we get to the current troubles, maybe you can give us some context for this trail system. It's been in the works for years. What is the vision? What is the mission of PRAT?
The mission of PRAT is to link the two more regionally significant trails, the Bonneville Shoreline Trail with the Provo Jordan River Parkway. Both of those trails are quite extensive, have the potential of being hundreds of miles. And the Parley's Trail would be one of the few east-west connectors for those regional trails. So it's if you compare it to a highway system, this is an incredibly important link for people to be able to move between those other two trails.
Mm-hmm. A crucial piece of this trail is the tunnel under 1300 East. It's near the I-80 interchange. And you call this passage the draw at Sugar House. Maybe describe the draw for listeners.
The reason it's called the draw at Sugar House is about 10 years ago, the city, along with a grant from National Endowment for the Arts and with some private donations, sponsored a design competition, and the winner of that design competition had dubbed their design the draw. And what this draw at Sugar House will do is it will connect Sugar House Park to the east with Hidden Hollow to the west, or the Sugar House Commons shopping area to the west. And obviously it's going to provide safe passage underneath 1300 East. The intent of the Parley's Trail is that everywhere possible, we want this trail to be a Class 1 trail, which means that a trail user's interaction or interface with vehicles is zero.
So it's just a constant footpath under from east to west that hooks up with the Bonneville Shoreline Trail. I understand that you hired an internationally known environmental artist, Patricia Johansson, to design the draw. And apparently she takes a lot of time and to research the environment, the specific environmental needs of a project before she even puts pen to paper. And I want to play a clip from an interview with Johansson describing this process and then have you respond.
This is why research is so important in understanding what the place is and what wants to live there. So there are many more points of view that need to be considered, not just my own personal desires as an artist, but also what's going to work for all those people. What's going to work for the animals, for the plants, what's going to work for the users of the site, of which there are many. Anytime you design a public space, you're dealing with all kinds of people and all kinds of desires, not just one.
That's Patricia Johansson, who designed the draw at Sugar House. Juan Arceloretta, describe her design and some of the research elements that went into this design. What makes it so unique?
Well, you know, in response to her comments there, you know, if you don't get a feel or a sense of just what an amazing person she is and what kind of a vision she has, I've got to tell you, it's been a pleasure and an education to be able to work with her. She was part of the original design competition team, and she continues to be very intimately involved with this project. For her, it becomes almost a child. Mm-hmm. She wants to see that the elements of this project that she had envisioned very thoughtfully are implemented. And so the lengths to which she went to research the history to incorporate these environmentally conscientious elements, it's truly public art. It's functional environmental art that will put Sugar House and this project on many people in the international artist community's map. People may actually come to Sugar House just to see this trail, but it's more than that trail.
I understand the inspiration, a primary inspiration, was the sago lily, the state flower. How did she incorporate the sago lily into her design?
You know, it is so hard to give this project the justice it deserves over the radio. And
well, give it a try.
I will try. I'll also refer you to our website where we'll have designs that you can see more intimately, or certainly call us or participate with Pratt, come to our meetings. We're happy to share this idea. So the sago lily, obviously it's the state flower, and on the east side of this project, which will be in the Sugar House Park area, there's going to be a sago lily plaza. The stem of the sago lily is going to be the trail itself, and that will extend south from the plaza. The plaza itself is going to be just south of the Sizzler there. The passage will go underneath 1300 East and come out just south of the Chevron and a new building that Woodbury is building and Westminster College is going to occupy. So the sago lily is going to be quite a three-dimensional plaza. There are going to be petals that come up out of the ground. A portion of the petal is going to have these these numerous seams that represent streams coming down into the valley. As you go out of the plaza and underneath the tunnel, there are going to be coal veins in the walls underneath the passage that represent some of the coal type veins that the pioneers may have seen as they came into the valley in East Canyon. As you go to the west and continue to the west, it's going to become kind of a slot canyon, a red rock canyon, and the walls And these are some of the elements that are at risk. The just the way the sago lily appears, the coal veins, this slot canyon. We want this slot canyon to be about an 18-foot high slot canyon, and in the walls of this shotcrete treated canyon, there will be pockets. If any of you have been in a red rock canyon, there are those spots where the wind and the water have eroded things away, and plants grow out of these pockets because the wind distributes a seed, or a bird will place poop a seed into the pocket,
sure.
And these plants grow out of the walls. And so we hope to be able to put the irrigation into these pockets and have the walls come alive. We also, in East Canyon, there are a number of hoodoos, or these red rock spires that you may see in Goblin Valley type of things. In East Canyon, there are a few of them. They're referred to as the Three Witches. And the trail anticipates right now, we hope we'll be able to build a number of these hoodoos that will, from the road, you'll be able to see these spires come up, and it kind of invites people into this feature.
So clearly, it's much more than just a passageway, a way to get from point A to point B. It really is art.
It truly is art, and it's been the design has been featured in a number of publications already throughout the world. At least 5 publications where people see this in the artistic community. They're like, we want to put this in our publication. This is incredible, Patricia, and so we want to do everything we can to make sure that every element of her designs come into fruition.
We're speaking with Juan Arcelorreta with the Parley Rails and Trails and Tunnels Coalition, known as PRAT. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So let's come to the current day. Last week, your group sent out a plea for help saying that the draw at Sugar House is in financial straits. What happened?
Well, and that's largely a... That's a bit of a mischaracterization. To answer your question as to what happened, well, let me back up. There are parts of this project, are elements of this project that may have to be scaled back, and those are what I feel and what Pratt feels and what all of our partners feel are the real artistic elements to this project, the elements that make this project so unique. The funding for a functional passageway under 13th East is still in place.
Not in trouble.
Not in trouble. It's in the bank. It's just a matter of we're short. We're short of the money that we need to make the sago lily pop, if you will. We want to use a glass mosaic kind of tiles to color the stem, to color the flower, to color the center of the flower with reds, yellows, and greens. It's not an inexpensive endeavor, but again, we feel, and our partners feel, Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, all the partners involved feel that we need to do everything we can to make sure that these artistic elements are preserved.
But didn't you have the funding in place before construction started? Didn't you have, or were construction costs escalating in a way that you didn't expect? I mean, why the shortfall and why now?
Well, I think if you do want to say or point that there is a shortfall, as you may imagine, anytime you plan this type of a project, and again, this was designed 10 years ago, there are elements of the original design that were lost simply because of the canvas that we're left with the reality. The corridor to the west became more narrow. Different elements have to be changed. That's just the way it works. You take a blank piece of paper, design a project. In a dream world, it's going to be this way. Then you come down to putting concrete on the ground. It changes. So what happened with the funding is that there were a number of delays. There were some surprises along the way, too. The delays cost a little more money. Some of the ways we had to bid this package out or this project out in 2 separate phases ended up costing us, only because we were trying to save money, but it ended up costing us in the long run. But we couldn't have really known that. Believe me, the people involved, the technical people involved with this project have said that this is by far the most complex project they've ever been involved with all the property owners, the utilities, the moving targets. So... for all things considered, We are very close to being on budget, but again, we are about 10% short. The first phase of this project also came in about 23% higher in bid than we anticipated. So there are some really unforeseeable roadblocks or bumps that came up.
About 20 seconds left, but what happens if you don't raise the money? According to the plea, you have a deadline by the end of the year.
We need $450,000, and I'd say by January 15th. The elements that would be lost if we don't get that $450,000, again, are those incredible artistic elements, including the hoodoos, the walls with the plants coming out of the walls, and the colored glass aggregates that would be used to color the Sago Lily Plaza. We need that money ASAP. You can go to our website at parleystrail.org and donate. There's a button right on the left side, or you can donate directly by mail and send your donation to P.O. Box 520308. Salt Lake City, Utah, 84152. That's the Parley's Trails and Tunnels Coalition.
Juan Arcelareta, I'm sorry that we have to cut it short there, but thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Juan Arcelareta with Parley Rails, Trails, and Tunnels. City Views is a production of KCPW News with help from Eric Ray and Jesse Ellis. Next time, a new documentary explores how breast cancer treatment has changed since the early 90s. Join us for that tomorrow.